Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And on this podcast, we never stop Duning. So it's Dune yet again. This is part two of the Dune series that we started earlier this week. So in the last episode, we talked about the Bene Gesserit and a bit about the neuroscience of pain. And today we're here to talk about what? More Bene Gesserit? Maybe some Spacing Guild stuff?
Yep, that's right. We're going to pick up where we left off with the Bene Gesserit, and then we're going to move on to the Spacing Guild. And I think the place I'd like to start is to come back to something we touched on in last episode, and that is the idea that the Bene Gesserit are chiefly concerned with politics.
Right. Now, we offered some caveats about that in the last episode, in that we often hear the word politics and think of like electoral democratic politics. The political situation in the Dune universe is not so lucky to have democratic electoral politics. They've got some kind of weird hybrid technological feudalism that has like an emperor on top, and then there's like an aristocracy of landed nobles, essentially houses who control planets as their fiefdoms, and then there's also a pretty large input from trade guilds, primarily the Spacing Guild, which controls the monopoly over the economy of interstellar travel.
Yeah. So, if you need a refresh, certainly we went over the world of Dune in the last episode. So go back and listen to that one if you didn't have a chance to. So one of the books that I was looking at for this was another fun collection of Dune essays. It was a book titled Dune and Philosophy. And in it, philosophy professor Jeffrey Nicholas, who also edited the book, he examines the topic of the Bene Gesserit in Facing the Gamjabar Test. He touches, on the point that they make in this, conversation between Paul and the Reverend Mother, that the Bene Gesserit are concerned with politics. But Nicholas points out that what we're talking about here with politics is politics in Aristotle's sense of the word. Political science, one of the three sciences he outlined alongside contemplative science, which would have included both physics and metaphysics, and practical science. So there's a lot of talk about tripods in the order of things in Dune. and so in a way that kind of matches up, I guess, very loosely with Aristotle's three-pronged approach to understanding the universe.
Man, I have not looked at that Philosophy of Dune book, but that sounds interesting. So does it get into like what is the philosophical outlook of Baron Harkonnen and stuff? You know, is he a Hobbesian?
There's a lot of fun stuff in there. Yeah, there's definitely some Hobbes. I know I'll touch on some Hobbes here in a bit. But there's also one, let's see, what is it? I think it's something like, basically like one article walks through the various houses and factions and talks about how they would have been thought of by, say, Socrates or whoever. Mm-hmm. So it's a fun read. One of the things about Aristotle is that there's a quote that's often attributed to him, the pretty famous Aristotle quote, "Man is by nature a political animal."
Yeah, and I think this is an interesting quote, partially in how I think it is often misunderstood, because I think a lot of times people take that quote to mean that Aristotle was saying that man is the only political animal, which he does not mean. He actually mentions other animals as political animals as well.
Yeah, he also refers to eusocial insects and so forth as being political animals. Though again, one of the reasons this is interesting to come back to this is because the Bene Gesserit are big about talking about the difference between humans and animals, and again, given their focus on politics, we can't help but go in this direction.
Okay, but so what did he mean by saying this then?
Well, I was reading a little bit more about this, and apparently this is an area where you can get into some amount of debate, and we're not going to go. There's this certain amount of philosophical back and forth on this, but I was looking at a paper from Cheryl E. Abadi, and it was the article "Higher and Lower Political Animals," published in the Journal of Animal Ethics in 2016. And she writes that Aristotle considered man's impulse towards partnership with others to be the most important, and that it is only through these partnerships that happiness is possible. It sounds to me like, that means that the Bene Gesserit are all about happiness, obviously. right up their alley. And Aristotle broke this down across the different dimensions of our interactions with other people, at the household level, at the village level, and then at the what he considered kind of the ultimate level, the polis, a collection of human beings who live together through the creation of laws, allowing them all to survive and flourish. And this is where we get politics, as the word politics.
I think there's a pretty good case to be made that Aristotle is on to something here about the fundamental nature of humankind, that sort of that what makes us really special is our ability to cooperate with one another. And it's not mm-hmm. that other animals lack the ability to cooperate with one another. I mean, you might say that, say, like a eusocial insect colony coordinates their activities even better than humans can. But humans have much richer ways of cooperating with one another than even, say, eusocial insects do, because we have things like language, which allow us to very, very minutely coordinate our behaviors and cooperate in ways that are have levels of complexity you couldn't really imagine without something like language.
Yeah. So Nicholas, coming back to his paper, writes that Aristotle considered politics a place for human practical reason to flourish. So it was the ideal place, not for everyone, but for the best minds to busy themselves. And, thinking again to the Dune universe, it's easy to focus on all the at times dystopian aspects of it, and the war and the intrigue. But it is a pretty cooperative interplanetary empire when you look at it from a certain perspective. They have managed to not annihilate each other with atomic weapons. They have this treaty in place, even though there's a great deal of inequality in the Dune universe. All these factions are working more or less together.
Well, yeah, and I think you can see those dualities all throughout real history as well. I mean, look at any number of empires you could think of, the Roman Empire or the British Empire. I mean, all of these are at the same time kind of marvelous achievements of cooperation and coordination at the same time that they are brutal engines of oppression.
Yeah. Now, Abadi discusses the same thing that you mentioned, that, that we discussed just a second ago, that, some take Aristotle to mean that non-human animals cannot be political. Others see it as the view that humans are merely more political than any non-human animal. But again, Aristotle puts a great deal of emphasis on language. And it is, language is key to the human realm of politics, in good ways and bad ways.
Well, yeah, language allows for a complexity of coordination that is that of course can serve both good and bad ends. So it allows for extremely complex coordination to service of the greater good and to helping one another, but also to ever richer layers of deception than could be imagined by any other kind of animal.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it pointed out that one of the things that our language does is it allows us to share particular points of view with others, perceptions of what's working, what's not working, of what's bringing us pleasure and what's bringing us pain. Now, I want to come back to the Bene Gesserit distinction of humans and animals. Again, this is, they're very much of the mindset, don't be an animal, be a human. The Reverend Mother tells Paul that the test is about seeing if he is human or not. And the Bene Gesserit training seems to a large degree revolve around the high application of reason in a way that overpowers animal instincts. Again, the example that is thrown out is that the animal chews its leg off if it's caught in a trap. But the human, the political animal par excellence, plots and practices politics over the fact of its entrapment.
Well, in fact, the very example she gives is one of deception. Remember that he would feign death in order to attract the trapper and then strike out and kill him.
Yes. And of course, this is in a way, this foreshadows what is to come in the novel Dune, because Atreides' acquisition of Arrakis is widely seen as a trap. And Paul's father, not entirely by his own choice, ends up in the position of the animal that must strike out from the trap in an attempt to punish his oppressor. It ends up not quite working, but it's again one of the great scenes in the book, and I thought a wonderfully recreated scene in the recent film adaptation. Now, coming back to the philosophy of Dune book, Nicholas uses the Gamjabar awareness test to make a point about the current state of humanity in our world, the real world, in particular, the environmental peril we face. He says, this is the trap. We are the trap, but we are arguably not actually human enough, not aware of our place in the world and our connections to one another to act in the best interest of the city. Quote, Herbert's philosophy of the human warns against two things, being animal and being a slave. As animals, we may be enslaved by our animal desires, but there is a different slavery, being a slave to the machine. The Butlerian jihad freed humanity. It freed beings from enslavement to machines, and it freed us to develop our human talents. Herbert isn't asking us to abandon our favorite playthings, iPod, computer, and game systems. He's challenging us to find out how to use those toys to live a human life. The warning is not to stagnate. Now, if we're thinking about environmental catastrophe, it may also seem counterintuitive to think of politics as the answer, obviously. But there are more than enough examples in our modern world of political barriers to environmental action. But of course, it is through politics, certainly in the Aristotle sense of the word, that anything is done for the greater good of humanity.
Yeah, in a very crude sense, I think this analogy works. Doing something about, say, environmental problems, which will eventually cause harm to lots of people or to everyone, may require some kind of initial investment. It's sort of like the marshmallow test, but for people as a whole. Like, can you actually do the thing that's going to get you a better outcome in the long run if it hurts you a little bit in the short run? And right. A lot of times the answer is no.
Now, right after I was looking at this material, I just happened to be watching a TEDx talk for other reasons, and it's one from Jill Bolt Taylor, author of My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey. I think we've mentioned her on the show before. She had this journey to recover from a stroke and wrote about it. Quite interesting. But this particular talk was the neuroanatomical transformation of the teenage brain from 2013. And Taylor's main points in this concern what happens to the teenage brain, but also just the development of the brain in general. And I thought some of her points lined up with a lot of this Bene Gesserit thinking and the concept of Aristotle's politics.
Hmm.
She points out that we are feeling animals that think, not thinking animals that feel. And we are all neurocircuitry. That's something that she drives home. And as such, we think thoughts. We then feel emotions based on those thoughts. And then we run physiological responses to those emotions. And for sustained or recurring psychological responses, such as anger, we wind up running the same thoughts over and over again to reproduce those same results.
Yeah.
And she drives home that, you know, we have an ability to pick and choose what's going on inside of our heads. And she sums it up by saying, you know, again, we are feeling creatures who think. We tend to be more concerned with the me rather than the we. And in this, we fall short of the idea of that polis, of the city that Aristotle writes about. So I think it's interesting to think about, like, political action, coming together, communal responses, planning towards future problems. Is these are things that, on one hand, they're difficult for individuals to do at times, but on the other hand, like this is something that humans do excel at. I mean, we don't have the same level of efficiency compared to eusocial insects, certainly, but it is one of the strengths of humanity that you know, virtually anything that we consider great in human culture, in the history of our civilizations, it is due to people working together and bringing things out of that.
But it's also interesting the way that the use of politics in the Bene Gesserit sense, I guess, reflects both ways of thinking about the word. So.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, you have them sort of executing long-term plans through massive cooperation. You know, they're coordinating activities on a galactic scale to try to serve some goal in the end. But you could also see them as, I think quite accurately, ruthless power seekers within a ruthless system, and that those are both true at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're definitely, you know, engaging in shadow government conspiracies. They are manipulating pretty much anyone they come into contact with to certain degrees. But yeah, then they also have these goals of creating some sort of a human supercomputer that will bring about some sort of balance and long-term success for the human species. But then again, I guess that is often, if you look at today's politics, I mean, that is often the case, right? I mean, you'll see politics who, yeah, have some sort of a particular aim or goal that they talk about that lines up with other people's estimations of what could make the world a better place. But then they've also got to play that political game, and you can argue, well, they have to play that political game in order to do this thing or to attempt to do this thing. But mm-hmm. then you also wonder, like, what is the actual driving force? Is it the good thing you want to do for the world, the change you want to enact, or is it that game and that continual grasp for power?
Well, you know, on one hand, I feel a draw towards optimism. I want to be optimistic about that kind of project. But I also think that people's real motivating priorities are often determined largely by their habits, by what they do day after day. Mm-hmm. And so if you get in the mindset of, well, I got to play the game in order to achieve some lofty goal that would be for the good of humankind or something, I mean... In a way, I guess that is what people must do if they want to achieve those goals through, say, mass action, which has to be coordinated through politics, probably. But I think there's always a risk of, by playing the game, your real values become the playing of the game. What is in furtherance of playing the game? Because that is what you have to do day in and day out.
Right. So like in the Dune universe, if you're a member of a great house, You don't want to just be trying to assassinate your rivals just for the sake of assassination. It's just because this is the way politics works.
But if that is what you spend day after day doing all the time, I think that ultimately will end up defining your main priorities. You know, when you're forced to choose between one thing and another, you'll probably choose what's in service of the projects you pursue day after day all the time.
Right.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for mom is Mother's Day. Because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage. A 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
All right. Well, why don't we move along to the Spacing Guild? And to set the stage, I thought we might do one of these little readings here. Perhaps we can drop a little ambience into the audio bed here, and we'll hear from the Spacing Guild handbook. Any path that narrows future possibilities may become a lethal trap. Humans are not threading their way through a maze. They scan a vast horizon filled with unique opportunities. The narrowing viewpoint of the maze should appeal only to creatures with their noses buried in the sand.
A point of order, wouldn't burying your nose in the sand actually be a good way to inhale a significant amount of spice and thus broaden your horizons?
Yeah, that's why I thought this was a great quote to start with, because, yeah, on one hand, that's the sand. That's where all that spice is. And, you know, that's what the guild is all about. And then on the other hand, the thing they're saying don't do is the main thing that Paul accuses the Spacing Guild of doing, of, you know, of not considering the vast horizon, but considering the narrow viewpoint of how to avoid catastrophes in the near future. And, of course, how to maintain that spice.
You know, this quote actually reminds me of something that's brought up in an essay I'm going to get into in a bit by a NASA JPL navigator who has written about the guild navigators in Dune. And one of the concepts he talks about in his essay is the difference between calculating a solution to a problem in a best fit fashion or in a first fit fashion. You know, these are very different approaches you can have. So one says you keep trying to solve the problem until you find the first solution that actually works. And the other is you keep trying to solve the problem going through all possible solutions until you have identified the optimal one. And of course, people think, well, you know, going for the best fit path has got to be better, right? Because some successful paths are better than other successful paths. But he outlines the fact that for a lot of real world type scenarios, even if you have supercomputers involved, calculating best fit pathways is sometimes such a monumental calculation task that it's functionally impossible.
Mm.
So, you know, they're saying, well, be aware of all possibilities, but there's also the possibility that being aware of all possibilities puts you in a paralyzing state of inaction and indecision because you can never finish doing all the calculations. And maybe you would be better to just sort of bury your nose whenever you figure out one path that works, just do that. Anyway, I guess we can keep that in mind as we talk about the Spacing Guild.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's refresh, though, on the Spacing Guild. Because certainly if you haven't read the book in a while, you might have forgotten some of this. And the Spacing Guild, they are present in Dune Part 1, the movie that just came out last month. But they're not maybe not in the forefront of things. So first of all, as we mentioned earlier, this is one of the great mental physical training schools, the Spacing Guild. And we're told in Dune that they constituted one leg of the political tripod maintaining the Great Convention. This is the truce among all the great houses and the Imperium that bans atomic weaponry and permits these kind of formal wars of assassination against rulers and key figures. So that way, you know, it's members of great houses that get strategically murdered as opposed to whole populations and planets due to, you know, a catastrophic use of weapons of mass destruction. The other legs of the tripod are the Imperial House and the Landstrad. And the Landstrad is the body representing all of the great houses. Now, by the time of the events in the novel Dune, the Spacing Guild is immensely powerful. They control a monopoly on space travel and transport, as well as interplanetary banking. And so some elements, like everything in Dune, you can easily think of parallels in history. For instance, the non-military aspects of the Knight Templars is there, as well as, of course, the East India Company, the Dutch East India Company, and various other monopolies you can turn to. Like, what happens when one group controlled something absolutely or near absolutely?
So there's something interesting about the fact that the Spacing Guild has this monopoly on interstellar travel in the Dune universe, which is that, if I understand it correctly, this monopoly is handled in a way that's different than a lot of real-world monopolies, which are maintained in some cases by force, you know, by military or paramilitary force, saying, like, no one else may try to compete with us. Or sometimes by just like wealth inequality, by saying, like, you know, we're the only kind of company that can afford the infrastructure to do this. But in the Dune universe, it seems to be that the monopoly is maintained not by any of these conventional methods, but by having a monopoly on the navigators themselves, a monopoly on expertise.
Right. And I guess depending on how you look at the nature of the guild navigators, the steersmen, the secrets and the knowledge of their creation, to whatever extent they are engineered or to whatever extent they are like a product of mass spice consumption. And then, of course, there are elements there as well. It's like it's about access to the spice. Mm-hmm. And the guild definitely values its access to the spice. But one thing I was really thinking about when putting together notes for this episode is the power of the guild is, just as everything in a sci-fi futuristic world is kind of, blown into greater proportions basically their power is such that if a great house chooses to surrender their planet in one of these squabbles and wars of assassins, they want to flee beyond the Imperium, the Spacing Guild will supply that house with just such a far-flung planet, or, you know, some territory on a far-flung planet that's called a tupile. And this is actually referenced in the novel when the Atreides are trying to figure out what to do about this Harkonnen trap that they've found themselves caught in. And one of the options, which they don't really entertain, is, oh yeah, we could do the rules of these various treaties. We can just go to the Spacing Guild and they will take us away to a planet that no one else can get to. And I love this because it reminds us that for the Guild, this is a true monopoly. And there's space beyond the Imperium. But since the Guild are the ones who control movement and mapping, they kind of have control over the shape of the physical universe for human beings. Their access to secret worlds and outside space, it almost mirrors, theological concepts.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I mean, this would essentially be an unprecedented state of affairs in the history of human politics, because normally, you know, if you get exiled, you have to go somewhere where you could be found, and there are probably already going to be some people there anyway. But mm-hmm. in this case, you can get exiled to a place where there's nobody there to begin with, and nobody can ever find you.
Yeah, it's weird how in this case, it's like a place is not real unless the Guild permits you to go there.
Yeah.
And in having this tupile option, it allows people to basically pass out of the world of human beings in the Imperium and exist in another state, almost like they've entered into an afterlife or something.
That's fascinating.
So how did the Guild come to learn of the use of spice in navigation? Well, I was reading about this in the Dune Encyclopedia, of course, and they outline a few different possibilities, but the basics seem to be that they were perhaps just casting around in the wake of the Great Revolt, in the wake of the Butlerian Jihad, looking for just anything that could aid them in navigation. You know, what can we do to enhance human mental capacity in order to help us handle this? And then they discover the spice. Or it's also suggested that perhaps the Bene Gesserit had something to do with this and introduced the spice to them. Now, how do they use the spice? Well, as we come to learn in the Dune series, these steersmen or guild navigators consume just massive amounts of melange, so much that they have been altered into a kind of aquatic mammal that breathes and drinks melange.
Now, we in the first novel don't really get a lot of insight into the guild navigators. Like, we don't really see them up close or get their perspective, but that's not true in the sequels, right? Like, I think in the second book, one of the main characters is a guild navigator. Am I right?
Right. The guild navigator that we actually see in the David Lynch adaptation.
Edric.
Like, they basically pulled they pull him out of the sequel. That's probably one of the most memorable sequences in that entire film, with these very, very mutant-y, gothy Spacing Guild members bringing out this great tank in which floats this creature that is actually just a human being, but a very exotic form of human being brought on by this intense relationship with the spice.
Yeah, I've always thought that was a great choice by Lynch. So he's like, okay, I'm adapting one of the weirdest novels ever into a big mainstream motion picture. And I think the thing I'm going to do is insert a scene that's even weirder than anything in the book that is not in the book, and put that right at the beginning. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really clear in the latest adaptation that the director, old DV there, he really likes the weird, and he likes to linger on these beautiful weird moments just in the first half of the first novel. Mm-hmm. I really hope he gets to make Dune Messiah as well, which he has said he would like to do as sort of a way to round out the trilogy, mm-hmm. because there's so much weird stuff in Messiah, because that's where you start seeing things like guild steersmen, and there's also a face dancer. There's wonderful stuff in there. Now, I was reading about the steersman in the Dune Encyclopedia, and I wanted to read this wonderful quote. Whatever faults the Spacing Guild may have had, when the day of the steersman ended, a real beauty passed from the universe. the experience of the steersman, breathing and drinking melange, rocking to the beat of space and time, swaying with the music of the spheres, led in their dance by the pulse of life around them, alive to every note in the pivan, both composed and played by their quartet, is beyond the power of words to describe or the imagination to conceive.
And so the Dune Encyclopedia, I think, is pretty pro-Spacing Guild. They take a side in the factional struggles.
Well, in this, I mean, they're really like, look, you know, whatever you have to say about the Spacing Guild, those steersmen, they were doing great. They were just, I like the idea that it kind of answers the question, well, would you want to be this? Like, why would this be an okay state? Because certainly in the Lynch film, you know, it looks kind of like a nightmare. It looks like some sort of like, well, just this horrible state. Mm-hmm. But if you imagine the Guild Navigator just, you know, feeling so alive on the spice in that tank, then I guess it makes sense.
But in the new Dune movie, the Villeneuve one, so I wasn't aware when I was watching it that there was a scene where we saw the Guild steersman, but you identified that actually they do show up. They're the guys toward the beginning of the movie that are dressed in what looks like a combination of papal vestments and EVA suits.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And one of the big telltale signs, of course, is that they have these orange domes over their head. Orange, you know, implying the spice. But yeah, it's easy to miss. In fact, I noticed that there were, you know, some people online responding to the film, and they were like, where was the Spacing Guild? And yeah, you can watch it and think that they don't show up at all, but they are here, and I think they'll have a bigger role in part two.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true, and I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have like one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage. A 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, well, I thought we should talk maybe a bit about the science of deep space navigation and how that would apply to the Spacing Guild. And as one of my sources here, I was looking at another essay in that book, The Science of Dune, we mentioned in the last episode. This one is called The Spacing Guild, and it's by a guy named John C. Smith, who worked in spaceflight navigation at NASA JPL, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And his bio says that he worked on missions to, I'm not sure what to make of this, to Venus, Mars, and Earth, and that he was part of the Cassini-Huygens mission to Saturn and its moon Titan.
Well, I guess you could argue that like the various satellites that help us study Earth science are missions to Earth, mm-hmm. that we have to go into orbit to gain that kind of perspective to study our own world.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, it might mean return missions, like
when
the probe is coming back.
That's true, because that too is a navigational feat.
Sure. Now, there's one thing that Smith actually mentions right at the end of his essay that I thought was really interesting. I'd never considered this, but it's a piece of historical context that might help us understand a little bit better what was going through Frank Herbert's head when he framed deep space navigation in the way that he did in these novels. So remember that Dune was originally published in 1965, which again is kind of, it's hard to believe. Like it always feels further in the future than that.
Yeah, to imagine that this novel came out before Woodstock, you know?
Yeah. It's strange. But Smith writes, quote, "During the time period Dune was written, humanity's exploration of the moon and planets was in its infancy. The first successful flyby ever of another planet was NASA's Mariner 2 craft, which encountered Venus in late 1962. In 1965, Mariner 4 became the first craft successfully navigated to encounter Mars. But here's the thing to realize, these were not the only two missions launched at this time. Smith's count is that these two probes, the Mariner 2 arriving at Venus in 1962 and Mariner 4 reaching Mars in 65, were, up to this point, the only two fully successful interplanetary missions out of 20 that had been attempted.
Wow.
So
that's impressive.
Yeah. I mean,
because you also have to, we also remind ourselves of like, why do we have Mariner 1 and Mariner 2? It was because it was considered so risky that we better just make two of them and send them both out.
Yeah.
Because there's a high probability we're going to lose at least one of them.
Right. So at the point Herbert was writing, even navigating simply between the planets within our own solar system was a venture characterized mostly by failure.
Hmm.
And so we today, you know, being able to look back on many decades now of successful missions, I think in a kind of short-sighted way, take interplanetary travel, or at least of uncrewed probes, kind of for granted in a way that we really shouldn't, like not realizing mm-hmm. how difficult this technology was to develop and how much intricate calculation has to go into missions like this to make them possible. So all that to say, basically, I think there's a reason that in 1965, this would have seemed like something, you know, interstellar navigation would have seemed like something that required an almost supernatural mechanism to explain.
Mm.
Though once again, the interesting thing being that in most cases, science fiction, that, you know, that mechanism is the thrust generation or the travel technology on the ship that allows it to go so fast. I think that's sort of taken for granted in Dune, and instead the real magic seems to come in the question of navigation.
Yeah, I mean it's a situation where the Spacing Guild and the steersman, they don't, you know, it's not just that they can, you know, travel through hyperspace, it's that they can come out the other side, that they can do so successfully.
Now, this might the idea in the Dune novels is that they travel through what they call fold space or folded space, which I think introduces its own hypothetical dangers. But even if we just stick to the problems we would expect to encounter traveling through real space, the problem of navigating deep space is more complex and interesting maybe than a lot of people would have imagined, because it's fundamentally different and much more difficult a problem than navigation in, say, a car, right? Some of the differences are obvious. For example, if you're driving on a road, you don't really have to plot a course at all, right? The course is already determined by the road that has been built. You just have to know which roads to follow and how far to follow them. But even if there were no roads where you were going, say you were just driving a dune buggy over desert wilderness, you would still have a much easier time because you'd be able to note the direction of your destination and more or less just drive straight to it, I guess circumnavigating any obstacles you encounter along the way. You know, you might hit a mountain or a ravine or something and you'd have to go find a way around it. But basically, you're just traveling in across a fixed map. And this is really a blessing with travel, right? The fact that, you know, if you're driving from one place to another, your car is the only thing that is moving in that scenario relative to the reference frame of the surface of the Earth. It's not like your starting position and your destination are usually also moving. But when you're navigating in space, everything is moving and moving within their own reference frames. So to travel to one planet or another, you can't just aim at the planet and then turn on the thrusters, right? If we're trying to fly to Mars, you can't say, where is Mars now? Okay, I'm going to aim dead center at that, and then I'm going to burn the rockets. You can't do that, of course, because by the time you got there, Mars would be gone. Mars is moving really fast. It's in orbit around the sun, and it would be somewhere else. So instead, you essentially have to plot an intercept course. It's not like sailing into a port, but like sailing to intercept another ship that is also moving.
Yeah, it's not a journey to where the target planet is. It's a journey to where the target planet will be.
Now, fortunately, the paths of objects like planets are strongly predictable. They follow an orbital course established mostly by gravity and inertia, and we've got good enough information about the orbital pathways of planets that we can predict with pretty high accuracy where they're going to be to arbitrary points out in the future. Though, of course, the farther you try to predict the motion of anything into the future, the more inaccurate your predictions will get because of the cruel of tiny inaccuracies building up over time. But then there's a second problem. Okay, so you can mostly predict where a planet's going to be in the future, so you can plot a course to intercept it. You know where it's going to be. You go to where it's going to be instead of where it is now. But there comes in a second problem. Given the vast distances involved in space travel, even tiny inaccuracies in the initial calculation of a baseline trajectory can end up sending you off course. And for a crude analogy to understand this, imagine you are shooting an arrow at a target 3 feet away. If you're off by like 1 degree of difference when you're trying to hit the target dead center, that's not going to matter very much if it's 3 feet away. But if you're trying to hit a target, you know, 200 feet away, being off by a little bit is going to make a big difference. And so this is one reason that when we send out uncrewed space probes to do enter the orbit of another planet or intercept a comet or something like that, you can't just aim them at where that planet or object is going to be and then shoot them off and let them go. You will have to perform repeated course corrections. You'll have to check the position of the probe periodically while it's on the way to the destination. Figure out its updated course heading based on the new information you have about where it is, and probably perform a new burn to correct the course heading because it'll be slightly off just because there's always going to be some level of inaccuracy that will build up over time, and there's no way to be perfectly accurate when you're charting a course through space. Now, there's one other thing worth noting, which is that while real-world space agencies now have plenty of experience with deep space navigation, basically all of that experience is found not in piloting ships from inside the ships, but in programming navigational instructions for uncrewed probes. So all of the space missions with onboard human pilots have been really close to home. You know, a few trips to the moon in the 60s and 70s, and then a bunch of runs between the surface of Earth and low Earth orbit. And as far as crewed ships go, that's it. You know, we haven't had a somebody pilot a ship from inside that ship to Mars or anywhere else. And there are some differences in this regard. The steering of uncrewed robotic probes introduces additional difficulties. For example, the distance between Earth and the probe will always create time delays. These would be, you know, limited by the fact that radio signals can only travel at the speed of light. So if you are trying to land a probe on the Martian moon Phobos, it's going to take some number of minutes for the information to travel each way. So you send an instruction to the probe, and it might take, who knows, you know, 10 minutes for it to get there. And then you got to wait another 10 minutes for it to send you feedback and for you to find out if your maneuver worked or not. But then there's another problem, which is that Smith has a section of his essay in The Science of Dune about the process of determining where a spacecraft actually is, which is crucial because to know how to steer, you have to calculate a trajectory. And you can't calculate an accurate trajectory if you don't know where you are.
Mm.
So to establish the position of a spaceship with accuracy, you need some kind of external landmark to reference, kind of similar to how you would use landmarks to recognize where you are on a journey by car, except, of course, this is over vastly greater distances without roads and with need for much greater precision because of the distances that'll be covered on the journey. So Smith writes that we usually calculate the position of space probes in our solar system with reference to landmarks such as the Earth's North Pole, or he also mentions a reference point that is the intersection of Earth's equatorial and orbital planes on January 1st, 2000, which is, of course, everybody's favorite landmark. But then, you know, so what you've got places like that, and you can determine the probe's position by, say, checking the time delay on a radio transmission, and especially if you can triangulate that with multiple receiver dishes. So you got different dishes around the world, and they can check how long it takes a radio signal to reach them. You calculate the difference between the different dishes on the Earth's surface, and you can get a pretty good idea with a pretty high level of accuracy where the probe is. And then you can also calculate its velocity by measuring the Doppler shift in the radio transmissions as they as they're received back on Earth. So again, the Doppler shift is, you know, the common example is how the pitch of an ambulance siren changes as the ambulance is moving towards you or away from you. Wavelengths of different types of waves tend to get higher pitched and become more compressed if the source is moving towards you, and then they tend to stretch out and get lower pitch as the source is moving away from you. And by measuring the amount of Doppler shift in the signal, you can actually tell how fast something is moving away from you.
Hmm.
But then, so here's another thing I thought was interesting. So again, in order to calculate a spacecraft's current position and path, you need to know the last best guess of where it actually was. And then from there, you need to predict forward in time using mathematical models of all the different forces acting on it. In a way, it's a kind of dead reckoning you need to do. You say, okay, at this time, I know the ship was here, and it's been traveling in this direction this fast with these forces acting on it. And so when I read that, I was like, wait a minute, the forces acting on it, would that include something other than inertia, other than the ship's initial velocity? And the answer is yes, absolutely, it includes other forces, much the same way that if you're trying to predict the path of a bullet, imagine, you know, somebody shooting at a target, you can't predict the path of the bullet if you just imagine it travels forever in a perfectly straight line out of the gun barrel. You need to take into account other things like gravity pulling the bullet toward the ground and atmospheric drag slowing the bullet down over time. Something very similar is true of spacecraft. So to get a spacecraft's position and to calculate its future trajectory, you need to know not just where it started and its initial velocity, but other forces acting on it, including things like gravity. The gravity is, Smith says, the most important of these forces in the familiar interplanetary missions that we have experience with. And this would be gravitational attraction exerted by the objects in our solar system, the sun, the planets, moons, and other objects. But actually, it doesn't even stop at the influence of gravity. The course of a spacecraft is diverted by other things, including, one would just be variations in the way gravity is exerted even by known objects. So the example Smith gives is that gravity is not perfectly symmetrical in the way it's exerted by objects like planets and moons, because these objects sometimes are kind of lumpy, and so their gravitational influence is slightly asymmetrical. There might be more gravitational influence in one part of the object or in a certain direction than in other parts or in other directions. But then on top of that, you've got radiation pressure from the sun. You know, so the solar wind might be at the back of a probe that's traveling, and that's actually throwing off its trajectory from what you would imagine just if you calculated, you know, its initial velocity from the rocket burn, and then maybe the gravitational influence of nearby objects. You got to take radiation pressure into account. If an atmosphere is nearby, Smith says you need to note drag from the atmosphere, and so forth. And Smith even gives a very strange and interesting example of a trajectory input that was once considered a real mystery. It was the so-called Pioneer anomaly. I don't think I was familiar with this before. Rob, have you ever read about this?
I don't remember, no.
So this concerned the Pioneer probes, which, you know, are traveling off into deep space. They're, you know, on a long interstellar trajectory now. But navigators kept finding that their predictions for the course of these Pioneer probes was a little bit off, even after accounting for all the known forces that they could think of. So the question is, could this be an indication of something unknown, some unknown force or unknown property of physics that hadn't yet been discovered? And the solution to the mystery was not that tantalizing, but it was kind of interesting nonetheless. It turns out it's probably not anything spooky about physics. The deviation from expected acceleration was probably due to radiation pressure exerted by the power source on board the Pioneer probe. So inside, yeah, they've got a little internal power plant, a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, or RTG, and this was creating anisotropic radiation pressure that was sort of meaning this, or I think the pressure generated by the waste heat from this thermoelectric generator was actually exerting a pressure that changed the course of the probe as it flew through space and changed it. It didn't, you know, the radiation didn't just go out in all directions. It was sort of, it was anisotropic. So it was going in one direction more than the other directions. And this was creating an accelerating force.
Yeah. And like you said, when you're dealing with long distances like this, just that little nudge, especially if it's unaccounted for and unexplained, is enough to send you completely off course.
Right. And then Smith writes in his essay that interstellar travel would probably involve even more forces acting on a spaceship to cause it to deviate from its course. And these influences would have to be understood and modeled mathematically if you were going to navigate accurately. But another question would be, again, you remember you need those reference points within the environment to calculate your position if you're traveling through space. You need to know where you are in order to calculate a trajectory. So what would those external landmarks be if you are traveling between stars, if you're in interstellar space? Well, Smith suggests the possibility of using pulsars. Pulsars are highly magnetized stars that spin around very fast, shooting out beams of electromagnetic radiation out of their magnetic poles. And because they rotate so fast and because they shoot these beams in selective directions, you know, it's not omnidirectional beaming. It's like it's beams just coming out of the magnetic poles. They appear from at the external observer's perspective to pulse or blink at these regular intervals, sort of like the spinning light in a lighthouse.
Mm-hmm.
And the intervals of these pulses can be used to identify what pulsar you're looking at. In fact, the Pioneer plaques, remember those plaques that were designed to go on board the probes in case an alien ever looks at this and says, hey, who made this? They used triangulation by pulsars of specified intervals to show the galactic location of our solar system. They were like, here's where Earth is. Though I think, to be fair, I recall reading at some point that the pulsar map on the plaque will no longer be accurate in the future. I'm not sure about that one, though.
Yeah, you got to read the fine print at the bottom of the plaque. Limited time offer. Void in Tennessee.
But pulsars are not the only option. I was actually reading a piece about this question in space.com from May 2021 by an astrophysicist named Paul Sutter, who is at SUNY Stony Brook and the Flatiron Institute in New York. And he was talking in this piece about a paper showing that you could use pairs of stars to establish position in interstellar travel. So I think in theory it could be done, but there are a lot of challenges probably ahead if we actually do become an interstellar traveling species. There's a lot we're going to have to figure out, and we may not have SPICE to aid us by creating prescience that allows us to predict the future, but there is going to be an awful lot of highly precise calculation involved.
We're going to have to turn to computers until we decide we can't use computers anymore.
Right.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app. Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things, and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, I'd like to come back to the philosophy and outlook of the Spacing Guild. I was reading in the Philosophy of Dune, there's an article titled A Universe of Bastards by Matthew A. Butkus. And in it, Butkus describes the guild as having, quote, a parasitic relationship with political power. So in this, what he's pointing out is that the guild wields tremendous power, even power over the emperor. But they never actually rule. They can't actually rule. They can't risk disrupting the flow of spice. They depend on it absolutely. You take the spice away, and the guild cannot do the thing that gives them the power.
Right.
And he points out again that the guild has no armies, but it doesn't need to because it absolutely controls transport and trade between worlds. And I found this quite interesting because it made me think about, you know, historically, what's one of the things that armies do? One huge role is disrupting trade. To besiege a walled city is to cut off its trade and travel and starve it into submission. I was reading about sieges a while back, and in the cinematic sense, we often think, well, the siege is about, like, breaking down walls, getting in there, and then taking over the city. But generally, it's more about strangling the city until the people who live there or the people who rule there give in and open the doors themselves.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the same could be said about navies. A lot of the history of navies is also about interrupting trade, trying to block access to ports or trying to intercept trade vessels.
Yeah, and so the interesting thing about the guild here is whether you're talking about blockades or besiegement, they have this power already. Like they don't need an army to do it. All because they are the only ones who can operate movement between worlds. So by its very nature, the guild is in a constant state of besiegement or potential besiegement with every planet in the Imperium. Now, Butkus goes on to compare the politics of Dune to Thomas Hobbes' 1651 work Leviathan, in which the author, quote, establishes a theoretical state of existence in which there is no centralized authority, but rather a collection of individuals looking out for their own interests. Now, you might say, well, isn't there an emperor in Dune? Well, yes, there is an emperor in Dune. But again, the emperor's in the emperor's house is part of that tripod, and it's all in this political balance. So it's not like the emperor actually does have absolute control over everything. Talking about the emperor that is present during the first Dune book. In Dune, it's not individuals but factions that are the ones looking after their own interests, their fights, their feuds, and these fights and feuds ultimately can threaten the stability of everything. And that comes back to the way that the guild operates itself again, because the guild very much wants stability, at least so far as its spice goes. They don't want to do anything to threaten that supply. So another interesting aspect of the Spacing Guild is to come back to the way it makes decisions. Again, we're envisioning the steersmen, these augmented and or mutated humans who literally breathe spice in order to generate the sort of limited prescience necessary to travel through space and hyperspace. And a big part of this entails seeing what the most immediate dangers are and dodging them. And so, subsequently, one of Paul's biggest insights is that the guild commands, such power over everything, and they depend on spice for their power. So they end up making all of their decisions in a similar fashion. They always choose the safe, immediate path. And while this ensures survival in the short term, and it keeps the spice flowing for them, it will eventually, in the long term, lead to stagnation for the entire human endeavor.
Oh, this is back to the first fit versus best fit algorithms. Yeah.
So it's interesting to think about this in terms of cognitive bias, to sort of reverse the Leviathan scenario and go back from the faction to the individual. as pointed out by Lauren and Grishma in The Safety Bias, published in Behavior Change in 2012, risk avoidance is one possible mechanism by which personality characteristics may be linked to anxiety pathology. And we see risk perceptions factor into a number of cognitive biases, including zero risk bias, in which there's a tendency to try to eliminate a particular risk, while other options would produce a greater overall risk reduction.
Okay, so in a sci-fi scenario, if I understand that right, that would be saying like, okay, we're going to design a spaceship that cannot possibly be destroyed by plasma cannons from another spaceship. But in fact, that spaceship is very prone to like toxic buildup of CO2 in the, you know, atmosphere processors or whatever, that you're just like overly focusing on one type of risk while ignoring others.
Right. I think things like, you know, the war on terror are sometimes brought up as an example of this, too. Like laser focusing on one particular threat when, you know, some might argue that if that same amount of energy went into other things, then you would have, you know, it would result in greater safety and perhaps in a more meaningful sense.
Right.
There's also risk compensation theory, which holds that people adjust their behavior in response to perceived risk levels. If they feel protected, they tend to be less careful. The more risk they perceive, the more careful they become. I was reading that like one interpretation of this has to do with like safety gear and things like skydiving, where skydiving from a methods and material sense, it has become increasingly safer to do. But that means people feel safer skydiving and they're more likely to take certain risks, that sort of thing.
Hmm.
It also reminds me of insights that I've read about climbing, where mountain climbing, where the danger is not the part where you're hyper-focused on every little thing you do. It's when certain actions become kind of automatic. And you kind of, I guess, to a certain extent, you feel safe. You're going to be more careful if you feel the danger. But coming back to this idea of a risk compensation theory, I was wondering how it might equate to the Guild. So via their abilities, they're constantly not only confronting simulations of possible doom, which, of course, us normal humans do all the time. You know, we engage in simulating possible outcomes that are positive, but also ones that are negative, and that can lead into a sort of fantasizing about potential doom. But the Guild, they seem to go beyond that. They have actual visions of dooms that they have to cleverly dodge as they navigate, either, you know, through space travel or politically. So do they end up giving into these visions of doom and grow increasingly careful? Or at least in some cases, do they feel safe and protected by their use of the spice? I think probably with the Space and Guild, we're talking about the overly careful side of things here. That seems to be in keeping with the safest path of the Guild and so forth and the way they're characterized. But perhaps the comfort afforded by the spice allows them to engage in some bolder maneuvers, at least so far as it doesn't threaten the supply of spice. So it seems to be a constant. Anything that threatens the spice, that's just a no-go. Like almost zero risk can be taken when it comes to that supply chain.
Right.
So it's interesting with the Bene Gesserit and the Spacing Guild, because on a very basic level, and I think that's one of the great things about Dune is that you can look at it at different levels. On one level, it's like these are just sci-fi magic versus sci-fi science, right? It's witches versus techno wizards of a sort, you know? But then it goes a lot deeper than that. It gets into like the ways they think, you know, short-term and long-term thinking and how they engage in risk, et cetera.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. So you're setting up the contrast that the Bene Gesserit being concerned with politics they're very much engaged in long-term strategic thinking, whereas the Spacing Guild being very immediate task-oriented are just like they're thinking one step ahead always.
Yeah, like the Bene Gesserit, for instance, we're told, you know, that they will actually make sure that things are inserted into native religions on various worlds that give them an out. That like, right. Like, oh yeah, well, in our traditions, it does say that if a if a strange woman from another planet shows up, we are supposed to give her a spaceship.
that might come in handy 1,000 years from now.
Yeah, it might come in handy 1,000 years from now, so we're going to do it.
Right.
Whereas the guild, they would be asking different questions. They're like, well, what does it mean for our survival 1 minute from now? And what does it mean regarding our supply of the spice? And I saw some papers online. I didn't really get into these so much, but there was one I noticed that was looking at themes of addiction in Dune and Lord of the Rings, because they both deal with, I guess, addiction to some extent. You say the ring is an addiction. The power that comes with the ring is an addiction. And, of course, the guild is, in a very real sense, addicted to the spice. But makes its choices in the way that I guess could be comparable to some sort of personal addiction level. At any rate, just another example of all the different levels at which you might engage with Dune.
Gotta engage them all.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close it out there. I think this will be it for this journey into the Dune universe. But hey, when Dune Part 2 comes out, maybe we'll dive back in. Maybe it'll be something else we get a hankering to discuss.
Oh, I'm sure there will be more.
And of course, we'd love to hear from everyone out there. You have insight into any of this based on your own experience with the Dune universe, no matter which path that ends up taking, you know, the original novels, the sequels and prequels, the movies, the video games. We didn't even get into the video games.
Video games. There's like a Command and Conquer style game, but it was Dune.
Yeah, various real-time strategy type things. I never actually played any of them, but I remember looking at stuff about them, and they look cool. There's also a big board game presence. There's, of course, the classic Dune board game, which I got a copy of. Man, I got it during the pandemic, so it's never been played. And there are a couple of newer Dune board games that also look very exciting, especially since they both have single-player modes, which is certainly a little easier to achieve if maybe not as socially engaging. Anyway, whatever your experience, if you have thoughts, write in. We'd love to hear from you. In the meantime, if you'd like to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find them in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. You'll get that wherever you get your podcasts. We have core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, listener mail on Mondays, Artifact on Wednesday, and on Friday, we do a little Weird House Cinema. That's our time to set aside most of the serious concerns and just talk about a strange film.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.